This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. How's this for fascinating? Each one of us develops in the womb in a fairly sterile environment, but in the very act of being born, we begin to acquire the trillions of bacteria that eventually live on and in our bodies. We inherit a lot of those critters from our mothers as we pass through the birth canal, and researchers are just starting to discover that babies born via cesarean section lack some of those critical bacteria. So what? Well, C-section babies have higher incidences of allergies and asthma. A few months ago, we did a show on C. difficile, one of those superbugs that's most often contracted in a hospital setting and can be debilitating for patients who get it. The bacteria that causes C. difficile can be kept in check by other gut bacteria. But when those white knight bacteria are killed off by antibiotics, C. difficile erupts. For some patients, nothing seems to help. But as we learned, experimental new treatment that involves fecal transplants, often from loved ones, may restore the balance of bacteria in an affected patient's gut, and it's showing promising results in curing C. difficile. I read in a New Yorker article last fall about a guy who had chronic ear infections in one ear. Years of treatments failed. But one day, he transferred some earwax from his good ear into his bad ear, and suddenly the problem was solved. Doctors and scientists who are at the edge of a brave new world when it comes to understanding the bacteria that make up a huge part of our functioning bodies say this is all fascinating stuff. They're still learning why some bacteria is good and some is bad, and why some is good sometimes and bad other times. They're still discovering how the trillions of bacteria affect our health, even our mental health, and how we might be able to harness their power for curative purposes in the future. Some of those researchers are right here in our region, and today on the program, we're going to explore a little bit of their world. We're joined today by Deb Hogan, Dartmouth Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, and Gary Ma, UVM Professor of Anatomy and Neurobiology. Deb Hogan, Gary Ma, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
So, Professor Ma, if we could somehow magically shrink ourselves down to the size of a bacteria and put ourselves on the human body, can you tell us a little bit about what that might look like? I mean, I'm imagining the cantina scene from Star Wars with Jabba the Hutt, where you have all of these very strange creatures sort of undulating in a sweaty mass of weirdness.
It's a jungle out there, Jane, both on our bodies and even more so within the lumen of our gastrointestinal tract. As you said, there are trillions and trillions of bacteria that kind of form a cloud around and within us. And
a cloud, that's such an appealing image.
Well, they're not standing still. And as we approach this in the way that you described, there's an incredible variety as well. And some of them are potentially harmful. Some of them are we have with us most of our lives.
Professor Hogan, where do they come from? I mean, I mentioned that when you're born, you actually pick up a lot of the bacteria from your mother. So you're inheriting a lot of that microbiome, as it's called, from your mother. But where do we get the rest of them?
That's a great question, and I don't think we really fully have an answer to it yet. But what people have found is that the microbiome in children evolves very rapidly after birth for a number of years, and then stabilizes. And so one might imagine during that time that bacteria are coming from the people they come into contact with and from the things that they eat. And then eventually the communities begin to stabilize a bit and they just regenerate themselves.
Why do they stabilize? Is that something else we don't know? I mean, supposedly, I guess babies are eating things that perhaps they shouldn't or putting things in their mouth and maybe picking up bacteria that way and they're closer to the ground. But, I mean, I touch a lot of surfaces. Why aren't I picking up just as many different kinds of bacteria that then inhabit my body?
I think it's true that we don't really know the answer to that yet, but I think a lot of it has to do with the interplay between the microorganisms themselves and the host. So there's a lot of development in the immune system and in just the structure of the body, you know, the mucosal surfaces that probably allows for there to be more radical changes until development has reached a point of more stability.
So like babies have a vacancy sign and adults have a no vacancy sign?
I think that's a good way to think about it.
Gary Ma, another thing that fascinates me about all this is, you know, every animal has its own microbiome. Chickens have a microbiome. Horses have a microbiome. Elephants have a microbiome. And there was a study that made headlines recently that determined that scientists could figure out which humans lived in a household with dogs because those humans shared some bacteria that dogs shared. And humans who didn't or weren't dog lovers or didn't live in a dog home didn't have that bacteria. So humans and other animals can actually swap some bacteria?
Right. And that's not too surprising. It's just like diseases that there are many cases in which a dog would acquire an infectious disease that humans are not susceptible for. But on the other hand, there are some diseases that can travel from species to species. And I think a lot of it has to do with our unique immune systems in which and that have evolved to be in position to take care of us and for us to grow and be healthy.
So, Professor Hogan, is this another one of those instances we keep hearing, you know, you should let your children eat dirt, don't let your children eat dirt, or make sure that you're constantly washing your hands, or it's okay to get a little bacteria. I mean, should you let your dog lick your face and not worry about it, or should we try to get some of this bacteria in our world?
I think it's really too soon to tell. I think that it's clear that bacteria probably do more good for us than harm on balance when you consider the trillions and trillions of bacteria that live in us and on us. So I would err on the side of exposure to microorganisms, but it certainly is too early to go out and seek certain types of inoculations.
We're talking today and learning more about the microbiome. That's the trillions of bacteria that each of us has on and in our bodies, and it affects our health, and we even pass it on to our offspring. We're learning more about how it affects our health today, everything from allergies to diseases to perhaps even your own mental health and stability. If you have questions about the bacteria we know and love, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Gary Ma, we've talked a little bit about what these bacteria are, how many of them there are. What do they actually do for us?
Well, I'm a gut neurobiologist, and so I'm most familiar with what's going on in the gastrointestinal tract.
And isn't the gut where we have the most bacteria?
Yes, that is where it's thought that we have a couple pounds of bacteria in our GI tract and that there are 10 times as many bacterial cells in our GI tract as we have cells in our body. So it's a pretty vast array. And some of these are located in our stomach. And then there's a decrease in the number, and then it increases, and most of them are in our large intestine, which seems to be the best environment for them to grow. In terms of exactly what they're doing, we're still learning that, and we're still just becoming aware of the variety of bacteria that we have in our GI tracts. It used to be that our window on the gut microbiome was limited to what we could grow in cell culture. And so this is how we knew what was growing there or what was existent in our GI tracts. And this would be from growing them from fecal samples and also mucosal biopsies. But more recently, with the advent of various molecular approaches, we found that we were only aware of about 20% of the bacteria that were growing in our GI tract. So this is the amount of information that's coming in is absolutely stunning. And the number of papers that are published on this topic is growing exponentially. And when we talk about all the things you asked what these bugs are doing, usually the statement starts with the word somehow. So for instance, I'm a gut neurobiologist, and I can say somehow the bugs in our gut are able to affect our behavior. And somehow the bugs in our gut are able to influence how sensitive our GI tracts are to pain. And so it's thought, for instance, that people with irritable bowel syndrome, an imbalance of the gut bacteria could be involved in this. And this leads to the idea that probiotics and prebiotics might be a good treatment for these individuals. But one of the things they're doing is they're digesting or eating undigested food products that, work their way to the colon. It's thought that they help with the absorption of vitamins that are getting to the colon. So some things like that.
Deb Hogan, what else?
Well, one great example of how little we know is in the context of disease. So one of the big research efforts that we have at Dartmouth is actually looking at the chronic lung infections associated with a genetic disease, cystic fibrosis. And one of the really shocking things that we found was that the profile of the communities, the types and relative percentages of the different bacteria that are present might not change in a patient over long periods of time over the course of a year, but the way that the lung is being affected by those microbes can change radically. So it is becoming clear that it's not only who is there, but also what they're doing. And so the next frontier, I think, is research trying to understand specifically what these microbes are secreting that is causing damage or protecting host epithelial cells and triggering different responses from the immune system.
So even in something like cystic fibrosis, which is known to be a genetic disease, I mean, passed on from your mother and father, there could be bacteria that play a role in how that disease presents itself?
That's right. And that can happen from a really early age. There's some work by Juliette Madan that has profiled babies actually from their moment of birth through over years. These studies are still ongoing and have found a relationship, in fact, between the gut microbiota and the organisms that ultimately colonize the lung. And it's with this particular genetic disease, with CF, it's the chronic lung infections that are currently the most devastating. So the microorganisms that colonize one site can also impact other body sites and contribute to outcomes in places, you know, as far away as the lung.
And it sounds like that's really at the beginning of the research into something like this. But what's the hope for something like looking at microbiome and CF, cystic fibrosis? Is the idea that someday you could take a pill that would introduce some beneficial bacteria that might help with lung infections?
I think that would be one great potential outcome. If it turns out that the initial colonization of a bacterium in the gut can lead to or contribute to subsequent lung infections, finding ways to prevent that that from happening would be wonderful. And also just understanding how two patients who have different composition or different organisms in the lung have different outcomes. So the disease progressions can be very different between two patients, both of whom have chronic lung infections, but they might have different mixtures of microbes. And the thinking is that in those different mixtures, pathogens behave differently. So if we can understand why, then we might gain some insight into how to manage these diseases.
Gary Ma?
Just to add to that, from the GI perspective, we know that one of the things that all these trillions of bacteria in our GI tract are doing is they're there to outcompete other more harmful bacteria. In the introduction, you talked about the example of C. difficile and how the bacteria that would normally be competing with them aren't there because maybe we've had antibiotic treatments or maybe they weren't there to begin with. And these are – it's often in hospitals that people are getting these infections where they're getting antibiotics. But so these bacteria are there living at peace with us and kind of outcompeting the infectious ones. And we know that with the GI tract, if things get out of balance, same thing in the lungs, then we have these defense mechanisms that are downright violent to get rid of these infectious agents. For instance, secretory diarrhea and vomiting exist to try to flush these harmful bacteria out of our GI tract.
So have we been fighting an unjust war for the last 50 or 100 years against bacteria? I mean, not only antibiotics, which obviously do play a huge role in keeping humans alive and have been really beneficial in modern medicine, but we're also seeing where they can have their downsides in something like C. difficile. But then also you go to the grocery store and half the products in the grocery store tell you they're antibacterial or sanitizing. I mean, are we doing damage to our really white knight gut flora?
Right. Well, I think we're overdoing it. I think one of the trends that we're seeing as we step back and look at all of the work that's done in this area in surveying the gut microbiome of various individuals is that heterogeneity is probably a good thing. So the wider variety of bugs that we have intrinsic to our bodies is probably a good thing. And the more processed foods that we eat, the less of that there is.
We're talking today about all of the trillions upon trillions of bacteria that live in our body and on our body. As Gary Ma said, it's sort of a cloud surrounding us, very close to our body and within it. And listeners, I know many of you have questions, everything from probiotics and prebiotics. Are they actually useful, to perhaps things that have happened to you that you want to know about, or other kinds of bacteria that we're just starting to learn about? You can give us a call with your questions. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, I'm talking with two researchers who have some insider knowledge into the microbiome. That's the population of bacteria that live in and on each one of us. These bacteria affect our health in myriad ways, ways that scientists are still just discovering. We often think of bacteria as bad, but it turns out we need these microbes to function. And throughout our lives, they affect just about every aspect of our health. Deb Hogan, Dartmouth Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, and Gary Ma, UVM Professor of Anatomy and Neurobiology, are sharing what they know and some of the interesting research being done by their colleagues. And listeners, if you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211 or go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and post your questions there. Let's go to Julie Lynn calling in from Burlington. Hi, Julie Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually had, it's very interesting that you were just speaking about this. I actually have Crohn's disease. I have had it since I was a teenager. And, you know, like one of your guests said, they tried, you know, treating with antibiotics. They tried treating it with chemotherapy. There's lots of popular, you know, ideologies about treating inflammatory bowel disease. But eventually, I actually got MRSA, or methicillin-resistant staph, which is one of those superbugs.
Mm-hmm.
Just from having a more advanced IV placed in my arm, and I almost died. I actually lost one of the veins, major veins in my arm. And afterwards, you know, the infectious disease specialist said, just go out and play in the dirt, and don't be afraid to get dirty, but stay away from antibacterial products and soaps. And you just need to let your body rebuild its system. And I guess my first thought was, my health has drastically improved since then. Don't get me wrong, I wash my hands, I shower every day, stuff like that. But I'm just curious, is that still, you know, kind of the popular thought? It sounded like it had before you took my call, but I just wanted to see if your guests wanted to elaborate on that anymore.
Julie Lynn, thanks very much for the call, and I'm so glad to hear that you're doing better. That sounds like it was a really scary time. Now, realizing that neither Deb Hogan or Gary Ma are general practitioners here, so we're not really going to be offering medical advice. Deb Hogan, what do you think about what Julie Lynn is saying? I mean, her doctor said, go play in the dirt. You've got to redevelop that bacteria.
I think it's great. I don't know of any research that has shown that that is an effective therapy. I don't know of any studies that have monitored a change in a person's microbiome after being out in the environment. But I think that's a wonderful study that should be done to see if we can change kind of our protective function of our microflora just by increasing exposure.
Well, you know, one of the other things that people are often told when they take antibiotics or when they have any kind of issue is eat some yogurt, get those beneficial bacteria into your system. And of course, now there's the huge market in what are called probiotics and prebiotics. And we have a couple of questions like that that came in. And I don't know if either one of you could talk about them. Ingrid emailed to say, do we really need to supplement with probiotics like acidophilus pills, et cetera, if we eat a healthy diet? Or will our body take care of getting and keeping the right balance on our own? And Whitney says, with all the new research on good bacteria, there's also been more attention given to various probiotic supplements. Do you think that these probiotics are good to take, or is there not enough evidence to support these supplements? Gary Ma?
I think this is still a new and emerging field, and so I think we need to learn more about this. I think if you're feeling healthy, there's no need to be taking probiotics or prebiotics.
And the difference is probiotics have the bacteria, prebiotics are the food that the good bacteria like to eat.
Exactly. So prebiotics are feeding or and promoting the growth of the good bacteria. So, but on the other hand, if you have certain GI disorders, if you have GI pain, there have been a number of studies that have been done that both indicate that both probiotics and prebiotics can help alleviate gastrointestinal pain, for instance. It's still up in the air. There are also studies showing that they're not making any difference. So I think the jury is still out on this. But on the other hand, they are available and they're not harmful. One of the problems is the way they're currently regulated.
Or not regulated.
Exactly. The lack of regulation for these, and you don't know what the shelf life is. So by the time you're taking these are, you know, they're at it's amazing to me that if you went in a time machine back 20 years and saw a yogurt that's advertising how many bacteria it has in it, it would be hard to imagine people wanting to eat it. But now that's what they're touting. But there's no guarantee that there are that many that are actually viable by the time you're taking it off of the shelf and taking it.
Because the FDA doesn't regulate
exactly.
The claims.
Exactly.
While
exactly.
We're on this topic, let's go to Lori in Middlebury. Hi, Lori. Go right ahead.
Sure.
Go ahead, Lori.
Well, we just, I guess you answered part of my question as far as research. We found that a few years ago, our daughter was having muscle spasticity, kind of like you would see in Tourette's, actually. And we began giving her a probiotic and noticed that it would go away. And then when I would maybe run out and forget to go to the store and wait a couple of weeks, the twitching would come back with a vengeance. So we just decided that we're going to stick with that. But I wondered if there was any scientific evidence or research to show that might be helpful.
I've never heard of that with a skeletal or striated muscle twitch like that. But this gets back to what I was saying earlier in the program, where so much of what we talk about, we start with the word somehow. There have been animal studies showing that bacteria in the GI tract can affect behavior in animals. And a lot of the work has been done in what are called germ-free mice. So these mice don't have any bacteria in them. They're grown in a sterile environment, so you can control this. And different strains of mice have different levels of anxiety and exploratory behavior. And an example of this is a strain called Balb C mice are very timid, whereas NIH Swiss mice are very exploratory and are pretty happy mice. So if you grow these in a germ-free environment and you take the bacteria from an NIH Swiss mouse and put it in a sterile Balb C mice, they start getting more exploratory and certain neurotransmitters and neurochemicals in their brain change. At the same time, if you take Balb C bacteria and put them in the NIH Swiss mice, they get more timid and less exploratory. It's just mind-boggling. The data are there, but we have no idea how these signals are getting from the lumen of the GI tract up to the brain. In some studies, if you cut the vagus nerves, these signals don't, particularly with the prebiotic treatments, the vagus nerve seems to be a conduit for this information. Whereas in other studies, you can cut the vagus nerve and sympathetic nerves, and the signals still get there, indicating that it might be hormonal.
In other words, stay tuned. We still don't know
exactly.
A ton of stuff.
On the other hand, these studies give us outcome measures that we can now formulate and test hypotheses to get at the mechanisms.
Let's go to Rajiv, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Rajiv. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. So I have a basic question on, do bacteria live as a colony? And how do they communicate among themselves? So is there a type of signal? Do they release?
Good question, Rajiv. How do they communicate? Deb Hogan, you were talking earlier about the relationship between, some of the bacteria in our lungs and disease. Do you know how all of these bacteria communicate?
We do. We That's actually one of the questions that we're very interested in my lab. And what we and others have found is that they secrete chemicals. So they communicate through the secretion of small molecules that can then bind receptors on the surfaces of other organisms, other bacteria, and change their behavior. And that's just one mode of communication between microbes or between microbe and host. They can also physically interact with one another through different proteins and carbohydrates on their surfaces, and that can tell them when they're nearby. And then simply just by changing the environment. So microbial metabolism can change the local pH of the environment, and the host and surrounding microbes can respond to that. They can consume some carbon sources and produce other types of foods that will enrich bacteria that they would like to have nearby, and can also change the local environment. So the answer is that there are many different ways that microbes communicate to one another and communicate with the host.
We're talking today about the bacteria that live on and in our body. So many interesting things that we now know and scientists are discovering, and so much still to discover about how these bacteria affect our health in good ways and in bad ways, even, as Gary Ma was saying, affect our behavior. If you have questions or want to share a thought, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We also have some great links up there. Or give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Michelle, who produces locally made kimchi, and she told us about a time one of her fermentation screens was accidentally cleaned with a commercial sanitizer. And because kimchi requires bacteria to ferment, Michelle needs that bacteria for her kimchi to actually become good. And when that sanitized screen was used, she said her kimchi didn't ferment at all. So she wants to know, does the industrial sanitizer residue in processed food contribute to killing the bacteria in our gut? Deb Hogan, do you have any insight into that?
Oh, what an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. But I think some of the approaches that have been developed will certainly allow us to ask that question in a controlled way. One of the advances in more recent technologies is to be able to differentiate between live and dead microorganisms. So the way that we measure them is by looking at their DNA, which is around when the organism is alive, obviously, but also persists after a microorganism has been killed. So the very new advances that allow us to determine which organisms are actually alive after exposure to a particular compound will really help answer that question.
Huh. We got a note from Helen who says, can your guests discuss the current studies related to the causes of obesity and gut bacteria? Gary Ma?
Well, once again, we're not at the mechanisms of this, and this is a very controversial topic. There have been some really high-profile papers that have been published on this. Once again, using mouse strains, where if you take a strain of mouse that is obese and take their bacteria and put it into mice that are lean, they start gaining more weight. And this clearly has to do with neurohormonal mechanisms and the satiety centers and the switches for stopping eating versus wanting to eat.
Does that come from satiation?
Yes, okay. Exactly. Feeding behavior, essentially. And also, you can take lean mice and make them more obese by once again inoculating them with bacteria from obese mice.
So we don't quite know, but we think the bacteria in our gut may have something to do with shutting off and turning on those things that tell us when to stop eating.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I read, one of the articles in preparing for this show, was saying that one of the gut bacteria that may be involved in that is H. pylori, which is also known then later on to cause peptic ulcers and an increased susceptibility to certain cancers. So does that suggest that some bacteria is good sometimes and bad other times?
Exactly. And this is one of the general theories amongst gut microbiologists is a lot of these bacteria like that, we want to promote their growth through a certain period of our lives, but then they can be harmful after that. And H. pylori is a good example of this. And this back to this idea of the large variety and the heterogeneity of the bugs, since we're chopping that down with the various antibiotics that we're taking and also back to the processed foods, less variety of foods, and being so clean, there are a lot of scientists who believe that this is contributing to the increase in food allergies that we're seeing and disorders like that, that this change in the microbiome is a contributing factor.
Let's go to Bob in Wells River. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. This is a fascinating subject. I'm glad you guys had the show on. I'm curious about antibiotics in animal feed and whether or not they can then carry through into our GI tract and affect the bacteria that are in our gut.
Bob, yeah, certainly all of the antibiotics in animal feed affecting the animals that then we eat, certainly a huge topic right now. Deb Hogan, what about it? You know, Bob wants to know how that might be affecting our bacteria.
So that's an area that I don't specifically know about in terms of whether or not the antibiotics that are fed to animals then end up on our dinner plates such that they're affecting our microflora. But we also have to think about how antibiotics could be just influencing the microorganisms associated with foods and just having them in the environment. And that will change the organisms that we're exposed to and that travel through us. And as we've talked about, that can have some pretty significant repercussions as well.
Well, and Professor Hogan, I mean, as we've been talking about this whole program, so much is still unknown about how all of the bacteria affects us, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't. I mean, are we going to come to a time where we take a pill that gives us all the bacteria we need, or we wipe out all of our bacteria and just put in what we need at different times in our life? I mean, this is a huge new frontier. Where do you see it going?
It's really amazing to think about all the potential ways that this could impact us. So it's clear that much more research needs to be done before there's an answer to that. But I think that's one potential outcome, that we could just inoculate individuals with an optimized microflora. I'm guessing that that's going to be a real challenge, just thinking about how different we are and how different our diets are. So I think probably the biggest breakthroughs will come in identifying dysfunction, figuring out when someone's microflora has changed in a way that's harmful. And we'll actually be able to take a more scientific approach to figuring out if the changes that we're making are bringing it back to a more balanced, beneficial state. And I think, as Gary mentioned, one theme that has been showing up again and again is that diversity is good. You know, that's true in many ecosystems, including our own. And so that could be one simple measure that we want to follow as we look in serial samples from individuals to find out when certain behaviors contribute to generating a healthy microbiota.
As a microbiologist, is this stuff exciting to you, Professor Hogan?
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing. And it's really all come from some technological advances. So there's been probably a 100,000-fold reduction in sequencing costs. So now we can ask questions that we were never able to ask before about how we're living in communion with our microbes.
Yeah, you were asking about taking the microbiome, you know, in a pill.
Right.
Just to add to that, one of the approaches that's being explored now is to genetically manipulate bacteria that we know will grow, for instance, in our colon, and have them make proteins that would be helpful for instance, to decrease inflammation. So if you have an anti-inflammatory cytokine, you could have bacteria in your colon making that anti-inflammatory cytokine and secreting it and therefore dampen inflammation. This could be helpful for Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
So really still a ton more research to come, and then we'll figure out how do we each individually get to benefit from this research.
Right. But our bodies seem to be good at maintaining the status quo. So, for instance, if you're taking probiotics and you're taking all these live bacteria, if you stop taking them, that strain of bacteria seems to disappear within weeks. And so you have to keep taking them in order to change the balance of the bacteria in your body.
Wow, well, this is fascinating stuff. Gary Ma is a professor of anatomy and neurobiology at the University of Vermont. Gary, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Deb Hogan is a professor of microbiology and immunology at Dartmouth College. Deb, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
And listeners, if you do find this stuff as fascinating as I do, head on over to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've posted quite a few links there to other interesting resources and articles, including a great Radiolab episode on guts and a Michael Pollan article from the New York Times that got everyone buzzing just a couple of weeks ago. So go to facebook.com/Vermont Edition. Coming up on the program, Vermont is attempting to come down hard on patent trollers, companies that buy up patents and then threaten suit against other companies using their protected technology. That's a perfectly legal practice, but the Attorney General says one company has fallen afoul of our consumer protection laws. We'll explain in just a minute on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, Vermont's Attorney General filed a lawsuit against MPHJ Technology for patent trolling. It's the first time a state has filed suit against a company for this kind of activity. Perhaps not coincidentally, Governor Peter Shumlin signed a bill which would help to make patent trolling cases enforceable under Vermont's civil statutes also last week. Bill Sorrell is Vermont's Attorney General, and he joins us now to help explain what patent trolling is. Nice to have you with us again.
Well, thanks for asking me to be on.
All right, so explain what the heck patent trolling is.
First of all, a patent, of course, is, somebody invents something and it's unique and they get a patent from the federal government. And essentially, they own the technology within the patent. And if going forward, someone tries to take advantage of that technology, they need to get permission from the patent holder. That's all legitimate under federal law. Patent trolling is a term that's come up in the last several years, and there are these companies that allegedly buy up a whole bunch of patents, and then they threaten businesses that are involved in using technology that allegedly falls within the patent, and they say, if you don't pay us, we're going to sue you for a lot of money for infringing our patent. And I think it's fair to say there have been national news stories that some of the companies that are resorting to these kinds of behaviors are something close to scam artists, and this term patent troll is come up, and it's, some have called it sort of a form of extortion of businesses. And we have a number of companies in Vermont that have been concerned about being victimized by patent trolls. And the Secretary of Commerce and I and others from my office have been meeting with this group for about a year. These are the kinds of businesses we want to foster in Vermont, well-paying jobs, non-polluting, high-tech sector work. And they're asking, can Vermont do some things to be more protective of businesses against patent trolls?
If the company has a legitimate patent, is it legal for them to go to any other company that uses the technology that's under patent and say, you need to basically license this from us or pay us a fee because it's our technology? That's
yes.
All legal.
That's absolutely legal. Where it is less legal or illegal is, one, they don't really own the patent, or they are suggesting that the patent actually impacts or controls more technology than it does.
And why isn't it obvious to a person who gets that letter what the patent actually controls?
Well, because the letter might just say we own patent number, and it's some 7-digit or so number patent, and you are sending emails over the web, and that's directly violative of our patent. And you got to pay us X amount of money, or we're going to, we've already retained counsel, and we're going to sue you promptly. Also, my office has authority under our existing law, under our Consumer Protection Act, and we heard that a number of small businesses and nonprofits in Vermont got letters sometimes one letter, sometimes repeat letters from a company out in Texas, basically saying, we own all these patents, you're in violation, if you don't pay us within 2 weeks, you're going to be sued, and we think paying us $1,000 per employee, we would give you a license if you do that. And we're doing this all over the country, and all kinds of businesses are settling with us and paying us their license fees. So we heard about that. We started an investigation, and quite apart from the new law the governor just signed into law, under our existing authority, under our Consumer Protection Act, to guard against unfair and deceptive practices in commerce, we, a few weeks ago, filed suit against this Texas company that is registered in Delaware. And we didn't advertise the filing of the lawsuit because we hadn't effected service on that company yet. And it was just the day before the governor's signing of the bill that we finally received notice that the complaint had been served. So it was really coincidental, but we publicized the fact that this is the first of its kind in the nation lawsuit against a so-called patent troll, and we're the ones who filed it.
What is it that you say the company MPHJ Technology is doing, and what's the technology they say is being infringed upon?
They say it's technology that relates to scanning documents and then putting them into an email and emailing documents that have been scanned. And they say they have patents that control the scanning and emailing technology. In their letters to that came into Vermont, and we contend they made a number of factual misstatements. We also contend that they did not do at all due diligence to determine whether these companies had, in fact, violated their patents. And we say they're in violation of our Consumer Protection Act. We want a court order for them to stop this conduct in Vermont. Two, to make whole those who have incurred expense as a consequence of receipt of the letters. And three, we want the court to impose civil penalties of up to $10,000 per violation against the companies. I think with the statute the legislature just passed and the governor signed and the filing of this lawsuit, Vermont is getting a reputation as a patent troll, unfriendly jurisdiction, and that's exactly what we want to be.
So you're not questioning, really, whether or not this company has patents on people being able to scan something and then put it in an email.
This is not about the validity of the patents. Those are issues for federal courts. We are contending this is a state court violation. We want to litigate it in state court, and it doesn't have to do with the validity of the patents, assuming that they do own patents. It's rather their business practices in trying to obtain fees or license fees from Vermont companies and nonprofits.
Under patent law, isn't it the responsibility, though, of the company that's being accused of infringement to prove that it is not infringing, rather than the company that holds the patent to prove?
That, again, would be an issue that would play out in federal court between the patent holder and the company that is supposedly violating the patent holder's rights. We are independently saying that the way this Texas company is doing business in Vermont, it is violating our state laws and that they need to cease and desist their business in Vermont to the extent that they want to continue using these practices. And I've read in some national media just in the last couple of days that the owner or principal of this company that has 40 shell corporations, mini corporations within the umbrella of his overall operation, that once our investigation started, they ceased working in Vermont. So if that's true, we've at least accomplished something already.
So the part of the lawsuit that you are filing that says the company didn't do due diligence in finding out what the violations are of these other Vermont companies that it sent letters to, that doesn't have any, you're not worried that that might fall afoul of federal patent law?
I'm not worried about the practices being independent of the patents. We'll see if the litigation ends up in federal court or not. We're hoping to keep it in state court, and that's why we are not contending they don't have patents, and we're not contending that their patents govern this or that and don't govern something else. We're trying to stay out of the patent fight and go directly at conduct that looks very much like patent trolling.
And as you said, you filed this lawsuit under Vermont's Consumer Protection Act, saying that that's what's being violated.
Yes.
But Governor Shumlin did sign this new law, making it easier to prosecute patent trolling in Vermont under a different act. So if you're unsuccessful, would you be able to turn around and then use this new Vermont law to some way get at the company as well?
That's entirely possible. We did not sue under the new law because actually the new law doesn't go into effect until July 1, but the new law does give us extra authority to investigate and to prosecute a violation of that law, which requires a showing of a bad faith on the part of the company that's seeking to have its patent rights enforced.
Bill Sorrell is Vermont's Attorney General. We've been speaking about a lawsuit the state filed against MPHJ Technology for patent trolling. Attorney General, thanks very much for helping to explain it.
You're very welcome.
And that will do it for today's show. Now, people with intellectual disabilities often have difficulty finding jobs, getting into relationships, even living on their own. But learning how to demand higher expectations from others and from themselves can sometimes be the biggest obstacle. Tomorrow on this program, we'll learn about the benefits and challenges of self-advocacy in the disabled community. Send your comments or questions or your own family's experiences to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us for that discussion tomorrow. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.